From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Donald Antrim is a MacArthur genius. He's written three novels, Elect Mr. Robinson for a Better World, The Hundred Brothers, and The Verificationist. In 2006, he released a memoir, The Afterlife, and 8 years later, he published a collection of short stories, The Emerald Light in the Air. He's a writer for The New Yorker, and he's in Wilmington to speak at two events. One has passed. The other is Writer's Night, a benefit for Friends School of Wilmington, happening tonight, February 7th, at Bougie Nights downtown. Friends School is an underwriter of WHQR Public Media. Donald Antrim, welcome to Coastline.
Hello.
And we do want to hear from you on this Thursday. If you have a question for Donald Antrim, you can give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Donald Antrim, in your fiction, which mostly came out of the 1990s.
Right.
You set up these unusual but somehow semi-believable circumstances, and then you start pulling this string to unravel it. It's sort of how The Hundred Brothers opens in Elect Mr. Robinson for a Better World. We're already in pretty weird territory in this 20th century Florida town.
Sure.
Where everybody's sink is clogged, and
right.
They're building moats and pits around their suburban homes
right.
That are armed with spearheads and maybe jagged glass.
It's a war zone, right.
Yes. So you put these townspeople at a Rotary meeting.
Mm-hmm. And my grandfather was remember going to Rotary with him when I was very little. Yeah, so that's why that's there.
And it's sort of this seemingly mundane Rotary meeting, and then this anthropologist decides to take the Rotarians and their wives through an exercise in which he asks them to choose and then embody an animal. Would you read part of the scene for us?
All right, this is from Elect Mr. Robinson for a Better World. It's an older novel. The anthropologist stepped from the stage and came forward into the crowd, gathered around tables set with plates that were littered with discarded skeletons of poached red snapper. The luncheon's fish course, provided by Jerry and Rita. He collected white, small bones from several plates and carried the bones back to the stage area and scattered them in a circle around my wife's chair. He produced a portable cassette deck and loaded a tape that played hollow drum rhythms. He intoned along with the drums, "There is a circle of sea, and you are in it, coelacanth, bobbing above the ocean floor where the lonely crab rests on rocks where no mollusk grows. Blue squid drift on black tides lit by lanternfish. The solitary shark pays a visit, but that doesn't concern you. You are the last of the ancients. Swim your swim." I watched Meredith's head and shoulders gently moving. Rita Henderson clutched her husband's arm. Men I knew and others I didn't sat still with their wives, all focused on my wife's feet, suddenly dancing like bottom fish above bone-strewn hotel carpet. The visiting professor commanded, "Rise, coelacanth, cavort in the blue cold." Meredith did rise. She hopped from foot to foot inside her private bone circle, head hanging, arms shivering, hands with tapering fingers churning air. She was working up a sweat. People in the audience swayed along with the echoing tape drum beats. Everywhere, heads oscillated and feet tapped. Abraham de Leon was particularly into it. His mouth fell open, his tongue wagged, his body visibly trembled. I couldn't imagine what kind of animal he was. And Tom Thompson, unlike Abe, Tom did not tremble so much as quake. He bounced in his chair in a violent manner that caused other guests to stare at him and cough suggestively, but Tom was immersed in his own head and taking no notice. And soon the whole room was shaking to the sounds of drums getting louder and the instructor's voice calling out, "Single-celled protozoa, insects, small birds, and wild fowl, warm-blooded animals and sleepy reptiles, crustacea, fish, aquatic mammalia, everybody join in with Meredith the coelacanth. Let's go, creatures, dance." Rotarians and their wives staggered from chairs and wobbled to the front of the room and encircled my wife in a bestial conga in which I alone did not participate. I remained at my table. I hadn't even chosen an animal.
John Jeremiah Sullivan, your friend, fellow writer, he writes for the New York Times Magazine, describes you among other terms, as an actor. And he describes this reading in Edinburgh when it was your turn to read. And he writes, as Antrim got up, the shift in the energy was striking. It was as if the rest of us had been reading safety announcements. It wasn't even the writer in him, not at first. It was the actor. So introduce us to you, the actor. Are you an actor? And does this actor come out in other ways?
No, I don't. You know, I studied theater, and I was briefly an actor before leaving that. I never really did it for very long professionally, and that was a very long time ago. I'm not really acting at this point when I read, but I'm aware of an audience, and I'm aware of time and movement and narrative arc. I'm aware of that. I'm trying to tell a story. So the theater also was a place where I began to really learn about dramatic action, about scene construction, about et cetera, et cetera. So I have this background, but I don't really feel that I'm acting. I feel that it's a fairly earnest reading at this point. It is, you know. Now, I haven't read that, Elect Mr. Robinson, for A Better World for many years.
How often do you go back and read your own stuff?
Not that often.
Do you?
Not much. I have this experience, and I've written memoir. It's happened there, too. When something has been written, however concerning or however long it's taken, and then published, kind of evaporates a little bit. It stops being a main concern. So when I do go back and look at things, I'm sometimes surprised by what I wrote, and I accept it to some degree. I don't think that the older books are as good, you know, as some other things that I might try to do now. But it's not really the issue.
Yeah,
you know?
And how has your style changed? Because I was wondering if we should even talk about some of this early fiction, because it seems like there's this moment in your life. It's like before the afterlife and then after the afterlife.
I think that I was trying to have fun when I began writing these books. I think that I had an idea that they're very conceit-driven. They're somewhat in the fantastic. They're concoctions in a way. I mean, they're made up. And then in 19, that took about 10 years of my life. I thought I would just keep doing that. I thought that this would be my thing. And then my mother died. And she had had a bad life, a hard life. And I had a hard life with her. She was an alcoholic who suffered her own psychiatric issues and pretty quickly began writing about her and writing about my family, which I'd never imagined I would do. I thought I would avoid that. It seemed mortifying to me. And then there it was, beginning. What changed? Everything. I think that my writing, I hope, became and can become more concrete, more descriptively simple. Want to play fewer notes and write a more direct and expressive sentence and paragraph and page at this point. And I'm less concerned with conceit and more concerned with experience, I think. But I'm older, you know.
It was 2006 that The Afterlife came out. And after that, you had a series of breakdowns,
right,
and went into a psychiatric hospital.
That's right.
Was it the writing of – was it addressing memories that had been repressed? Was it going through that process of pulling this together that brought that stuff up?
Well, yeah. It was a rough book to write. It was an anxiety producing book to write. I used to say that the refuge that I could take would be in writing, and then when I got up from the desk, I needed refuge. I blamed the book for a long time. I was in the hospital when it came out. I couldn't really particularly much. I couldn't even read it at that point. And I blamed writing, and I thought for a long time that when I was younger, had I made other choices, I might have had a better life. And I lived in New York and didn't have a family and so forth and so on.
But
so
you don't blame the book now?
No. But what I just mean to say that I couldn't really do much, and I regretted having written it, and I regretted having chosen to learn to write it. I don't now, no. But I think that I had a strong reaction, you know, to that anxiety and to the fear around betrayal, what felt like betrayal, what felt like giving up my own story. And I was new to memoir. You know, I still thought it was somehow about me, you know. And I don't really feel that way about memoir now. I don't really feel that I'm telling my story so much as I'm making a story out of my story, and that a reader can make a story with that story. In other words, I don't really worry about what people might know about me. I'm concerned with what people might know or find out about themselves and in their own lives and in their own imaginations reading. So at the time, though, I didn't understand that. I didn't know that I wasn't simply spilling the beans on my family in a way.
At the time, it was
threatening. At the time, I felt tremendous dread and tremendous guilt and tremendous shame, sure, you know, and that contributed to a breakdown, yes.
And we're about to go to break, but when we come back, I want to talk about this commencement speech that you gave to a graduating class from Woodbury Forest School, your alma mater.
My alma mater.
It was later published in The New Yorker.
Right.
And in that speech, you asked the students to consider, the graduating class, whether they have something that they keep to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a conversation with writer and MacArthur genius Donald Antrim. When we return from the break, we will hear from some listeners. You can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or email your question to coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Donald Antrim is a writer for The New Yorker. He's the author of three novels, one memoir, and a collection of short stories, The Emerald Light in the Air. He's also a MacArthur genius. And he's appearing tonight, February 7th, at Bougie Nights in downtown Wilmington as part of a benefit for Friends School of Wilmington, a WHQR underwriter. But he's with us right now and answering your questions on this Thursday. You can reach us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. And Donald Antrim, just before we went to break, I raised it was 2015, the graduating class of 2015, you were giving a commencement speech at Woodbury Forest School.
Right.
And you said to the class, do you have something that you keep to yourself, something that won't go away or that causes some feeling to occur but that you are maybe afraid to talk about, to imagine, or openly pursue? Do you have an idea that you fear other people, even your own family, might not understand or appreciate? Do you have something that you are afraid to look into that seems off limits? Do you have something that you protect? Is there anything that you're still protecting?
Yeah, I mean, there certainly must be, but I think that a lot of that has begun to unravel for me. I mean, not unravel, but I mean, I feel more, maybe it's the opposite of that. It's not really unraveling. It's more that I feel safer. I feel a little bit more like I can talk about my own experience and write about my own experience safely. When I wrote The Afterlife and published that, I didn't feel safe. And I didn't understand that I was and that I would be and that readers would not be worried about Donald Antrim. They'd be worried about something else. And that my job is to do a good job, technically, write well, you know, and that will carry a reader. So my sense of my job as a writer has changed over the years.
And do you find that the more vulnerable or defenseless, I guess, you become, the more people actually identify with you? I remember there was John Jeremiah Sullivan, your friend, wrote this profile about you in the New York Times Magazine.
Right.
He was referring to another interview that you'd done with someone else, and this person had asked you about a construct in Elect Mr. Robinson for a Better World and said, do you ever worry that people are going to wonder what goes on in the mind of Donald Antrim? What kind of guy, what kind of mind can come up with this?
Right.
But you're not there anymore.
Not really. I mean, those were very important books to write. They're technically difficult, very challenging. They work in the fantastic. I had a lot to learn, and I learned some things from them. I mean, a lot of appreciation for that time. It was fun. Kind of like living on a hope and a prayer. You know, I didn't know if things would work out, and I was broke and in New York, and those were challenging but interesting and important years. After I began to write about my family, everything began to change. My writing had to change, and my relationship to it changed, and my relationship to readers changed. No, I'm not there anymore. My life is quite different now, you know. So because of the hospitalizations, because I had those breakdowns, I might as well just go ahead and say what they were, so that we're not being cryptic.
Yeah, please.
In 2006, I was hospitalized for 4 months up at Columbia. I had finally an unsuccessful drug trial for 8 weeks and then was for 2 months in ECT, in electroconvulsive therapy, which used to be called shock.
Right.
And I came out of the hospital in the late summer really feeling like I was beginning a new life. But it wasn't over. The struggling went on, and I rehospitalized in 2010 at the end of the year and stayed for another 4 months and had 30 some odd more rounds of electroconvulsive therapy and left suicidal this time. I had really a long, long, long trip through this, and I don't really know sometimes how I'm here except for the help of others, my doctors, the doctors and the nurses.
Yeah. And we just lost power for a second. We're back.
Are we back?
Yeah.
Okay.
You were saying you don't really know how you got through it. You credit the doctors and the
nurses.
I credit
the fact that I had a world and that I sought help and I stayed in the hospital and I didn't leave and I stayed with it, I guess. But what I'm trying to get at now, I think, is not just to remember that, but to say that's where my writing is going. That's what I'm trying to deal with now. And
there's this point in the afterlife where you write, when you are as I was and as I am,
right,
the anxious child of a volatile childlike mother, you learn how to appear to accept as realistic and viable statements and opinions that are clearly ludicrous. Can you... It sounds like this is almost part of the journey in your writing and in your life, going from the ludicrous to the concrete, to drawing your own boundaries.
I began therapy when I was about 23 in New York, and I've been doing it ever since. And for me, it's been, I mean, I've had to do it, and it's shaped my life. But I think for me too, it's been a long process of finding a way to tell a story of my own childhood and my own life that does make sense, that's complete, that's compassionate to the other people, toward everyone else, toward myself, that doesn't seem so self-hating, on and on. You know, when we're trying to tell the stories of our traumas, or we have a lot to grapple with. So my way to do that is in writing, you know, and so I have that. I can do that. And I think that helped save my life, too. You know, at a certain point when I realized that writing wasn't going to kill me, I was able to come back to it, you know. And so now I feel that I have, some important questions about what I went through and maybe a few observations.
And you do talk about there was a period when you were in the hospital when you would look in the mirror and you wouldn't see yourself as everybody else saw you. You would see what?
It got pretty bad. I mean, I just got to the point where I was hallucinating. You know, I didn't have motor control. I couldn't really walk a straight line. Everything degrades. Tactility degrades. Sensory apprehension degrades. The light was hard to look into. Sounds. I couldn't really have sounds very much.
What did you see in the mirror?
I'm not sure. I'm going to have to describe it in order to describe it. But I'm going to try to, in a dimensional way, describe the psychosis. And what I saw in the mirror was my skull, you know, deformed, and at the same time, I knew that it was me and my face, and so that's a visual a moment of visual psychosis.
And right? You also were aware of your friend's reaction at this point. You knew that you couldn't hold a glass of water steadily, and you were aware that their observation of that.
Well, my visitors, I think my visitors were like a lot of hospital visitors who come and sit and don't really quite know what to do. And I could feel that, you know, I could feel that. Because I was in bad shape and I looked bad and I wasn't getting better and it was taking months and months and months twice. And so yeah, I was always aware of myself on the margins, as it were.
It was David Foster Wallace who actually talked you into undergoing electroconvulsive therapy.
Yeah, I didn't know him really. I'd met him a couple of times, and we had mutual friends. And there was a day after, I don't know, 2 months in this first trip, and I wasn't getting better. And at the end of 2 months, I had a meeting or was called to a meeting with all the doctors and the nurses. I was sitting in a kind of a circle. And I sat in the middle on a stool and wept and cried while I was offered ECT, which seemed to me, in the psychosis, the most dangerous and frightening thing I could imagine. I thought that I would be put out by it. I mean, really finished. And I think a lot of people do feel that way. It's been one of the traditional associations to it. And I think it was that very day or the next day, but it might have been that day. It might have just been a few hours later that someone called my name on the ward. Phone for you. And I got on the phone and it was David Foster Wallace. And he said, a friend told me about this and told me where you were, what's happening. And he told me that he was calling to tell me that if the doctors offered ECT, that I should do it. And I asked him to repeat that for an hour or so, because I couldn't take it in and I couldn't really take reassurances. And he told me about his experiences and
did
assured
part of you
me,
worry that you were going to lose your inner
absolutely
writer?
Absolutely. Like, absolutely. I had those fears and I had those dreads and I had that. I was terrified. I mean, I was, you know, if you're in the situation that I was in or if you're in the illness that I was in, you'd be terrified. So taking a measure like that, it seemed final to me. But I did it, and I did it again because of that. I mean, I think I would have had to do it eventually anyway, but I was able to then go to the hospital, go to the doctors, I mean, and say, let's go, let's start. So he got me in, you know, and I will write about the ECT, and I'll write about lying there and looking at the ceiling and what they're doing and what it's like.
And you're going to publish this in The New Yorker.
Yeah, there's something happening next week. There's something from the beginning of what I it's a book, I guess, that I've been trying to write for 12 or 13 years since this all began. And it's only in the last few years that I've been able to do it. And so now it's beginning, and it's a story of this time. But I also want to change the ways we think about suicide and about that illness.
It was the night of your 50th birthday? That you learned of, that was the same day that.
Yeah, that was.
David,
that's right. That's exactly
Foster
right.
Foster Wallace.
Well, he had died a few days before, and I found out that night.
Okay.
But that was when I found out. Yeah. Yeah.
And so there was a point after you came out of the hospital mm-hmm. that you thought about suicide a lot.
Yeah, I'm going to contest this idea that we think about it. I'm going to try to make the point that we inhabit, as it were, this, that it inhabits us, as it were. But yes, I was acutely suicidal for several years after that, out on the street. Eventually, we were able to deal with it better, and I was able to deal with it better. But I've had a long, long, long recovery, a long time, and I think that the recovery has been probably the most difficult part.
Is the recovery over?
Never. Never. I'll keep doing that, you know. I'll keep working at it, you know, for the rest of my life. Yeah.
You've talked about how you did you have a tarp in your apartment?
Oh yeah, or, yeah, I did. I did. I had it stuffed under the bed. It was for something. It was from something that was shipped.
And
so
you often thought about pulling out the tarp.
No, I did. This is part of what I'm writing now. So yeah, I was very close for a long time to the act, and so that's what I'm writing about. The problem of suicide in society, the problem of understanding and describing suicide, the problem of the more poetic and metaphoric literary description of suicide. I think that if we can describe the illness in concrete terms, that if we can make a simpler and more exact description, we can learn more.
Are you saying that we romanticize it in literature in some
ways?
Well,
I think that largely we romanticize it because we see it as an enigma. We don't understand it. I think that all of our diseases are, you know, take on a kind of mythic component until we understand them better. And we think of consumption as opposed to, say, tuberculosis, for instance, something like that. You know, this is a big mystery to us. And I think that anyone who can try to describe a little bit of it is going to help, probably. I don't know what I'll be able to do, but I want to stand up for it, as it were.
So, well, talking about what this is, you write in The Emerald Light in the Air, which is one of the short stories mm-hmm. in the collection of the same name, about Billy, who also thinks about suicide. And you write, when he touched himself to find where the pain was coming from, he couldn't find the spot.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's a sense of things being everywhere and nowhere at the same time. Everything hurts. We'll say it seems to hurt in every cell, for instance. And I think that's reasonable to think about in physical terms, to imagine as something that we're not imagining, but something that has some basis. I see suicide as an illness, not just an act. And I think that the dying is going on before the act.
Is that what you mean? When in Fed, which was a piece published
right.
in The New Yorker, you write about the aftermath from the psychiatric hospital,
right.
living alone, having no appetite, ordering from a diner in the wee hours
right.
every night / morning,
right.
despite your love of cooking.
Right.
And you describe this slow progress toward suicide interrupted by the work on your part, the doctors, the nurses,
right.
the people in the diner.
Right.
And you say, for me in those days, as for most acutely suicidal people, testaments and promises and occasional glimpses of light didn't always avail. It's in the body, the problem. It's not an idea or a thought.
I think it's a symptom. I mean, I understand it as an illness of trauma and isolation. I really understand it as an illness of isolation.
And what kept you from taking your life?
I don't know. In this beginning of this, I guess, book that I'm writing, begins with the day that I spent on the roof. Of my building. And
in Brooklyn.
Yeah. And, you know, pretty much hanging from the fire escape for a while. And I stayed up there for 5 or 6 hours. I'm not really sure how long. And that began my hospitalizations. So I'm not really sure. I don't really know what made that difference, because it could have happened pretty easily.
Mm-hmm.
I just had to slip or something.
Yeah.
So when I say I'm not really sure how I'm alive, I mean it. You know, but I am, and I'm here to do this. So, to do this writing now. So I feel that I have a kind of a. It's given me a job to do. It's given me a concern beyond my own writing, beyond myself, beyond whatever kind of artistic work that I thought I would accomplish. It's a deep. Maybe my main. concern for these years.
So with a psychosis, with a psychotic breakdown, to survive, you're forced into a psychiatric hospital. And, I mean, I don't mean that you were forcibly put in there. I just mean that that's such an extreme set of circumstances.
I think in a real emergent psychosis, the hospital is really the only institution that we have that can keep you alive.
Right. But do you think that there are other people that struggle with some form of mental illness that don't reach such a point that forces them into a circumstance where they have to work on healing from it?
Everywhere. Absolutely everywhere. Yeah, sure. I mean, my hospitalizations were an education. I mean, it was a radicalization almost toward this. I think that you know, in this illness, well, I'll call it that, we live on the margins. We live, you know, in a state in which we are shunned, feel shunned. I'd never experienced discrimination or predation, and I have now, though, since I've been through this. I mean, when you go onto the ward, your life changes, when you come out.
What do you mean by predation? In the hospital, you mean?
No, not in the hospital. They're just stories from my life of after I was in the hospital. There are some stories of things that happened and went on that were, related to my having been sick and weak. But I, rather than get into that, I just want to say that it changed my relationship to everything, right? To people, to choices, to.
You're listening to Coastline. Donald Antrim, author, MacArthur genius, writer for The New Yorker, is my guest today. You can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. When we come back from this short break, we'll have one more segment for you to get your question in. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. It was in the 1990s that Donald Antrim produced three works of fiction, Elect Mr. Robinson for a Better World, The Hundred Brothers, and The Verificationist, that last one, actually, 2000. In the mid-aughts, he crafted a memoir, The Afterlife, and 8 years later, he put out a collection of short stories, The Emerald Light in the Air. In 2013, he was awarded a MacArthur Genius Award. It was after the publication of his memoir that he suffered a series of breakdowns, went into a psychiatric hospital, and underwent electroconvulsive therapy, colloquially known as shock therapy. Donald Antrim currently writes for The New Yorker, and that's where he expects to publish some work going into depth about his mental health struggles. You can ask your own question on this Thursday by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can send an email to coastline@whqr.org. This is the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your question or comment in. And Donald, I want to read an email from Don. He asks, do you like to read books? And how often do you read and finish reading books? And do you read more these days than you did before the breakdown?
Well, I don't think I read more than these days than I did when I was very young, for one thing. I read all the time. It's all I did. And that's not really true so much now. Yes, I do. I read. I'm professionalized. I'm professionalized, for the last 35, 40 years. So that took a lot of the fun out of it, actually. I listen to music. I don't play an instrument. That's fun, So also going on the ward and having psychotic breakdowns and doing that for 10 years will really take a bite out of your reading as well and everything else. So there were years when I didn't read much or really read. And there were years when I really didn't write. And that's why there were so few books in that period. I wrote 4 or 5 stories over the course of 8 or 9 years.
Your father was a literature professor. And in your memoir, The Afterlife, you write about your discovery of books and moments when you would try to spark a conversation with your father about what was on the bookshelf, learn from him about the home collection, and he wouldn't really go with you there, which seems so strange. You'd think someone who teaches literature at the university level would dive in lustily to that kind of a conversation with his son, especially when his wife, your mother, wasn't much of a reader herself.
Well, you would think.
How do you process that now?
I'm still trying. You know, my father was a very taciturn, withdrawn man. He didn't make much of a relationship with his son in these ways. So I was left, you know, in a house full of books, just poking around, you know. So I read. But I lived my childhood pretty much on my own in that family. So books were a part of the problem of my life and part of the scenery of my life, and then they became part of my life, and they still are. But my relationship to reading has changed. I'm not the enthusiastic reading kid I was. I read more critically. I read more, say, professionally. Reading a big novel from the 19th century, that would be just a vacation at this point, you know. So I do and always will. But that's an answer to the question, I guess.
And there's a point when you describe in your memoir, you're traveling to your mother's side. Mm-hmm. She's
mm-hmm.
dying.
Mm-hmm.
And you're on the phone with your father, who is talking about what might happen to the cats during – he's in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a hurricane coming.
Oh, right.
And he's worried about shielding the cats
right.
during the hurricane.
Oh, right.
And you – slam down the phone after yelling at him, "My mother is dying. She's dying." And it seems like an unusual moment for you. Is that a rare moment in your father when suddenly you write that you feel powerless after that, but in some ways you asserted your power to establish the priority of the moment, the right reality of the moment?
There was never really any way to know in that family or in for many of us, I think, who grow up in very alcoholic, very violent families. There's really not any way to know what is ever going to be the right relationship to life and death. Maybe that's part of what my life has been, is trying to find a balanced relationship to life and death, to find peace in my own home, for instance, you know. But, yeah, I mean, it wasn't exactly a rational world. At that time, or any time in my childhood, so I remember that now. I hadn't really thought about that. He was frantic about the cats. He was frantic, and of course, I have anxiety. I get frantic about every other thing as well. So he was having terrible anxiety, you know.
When you talked earlier in our discussion about healing and mm-hmm. grappling with mental health struggles, you talk about how isolation is such a big part of that.
Yeah.
And the antidote to that then would be connection.
I'm really...
How do you build connections?
Slowly, you know, carefully.
And where do you seek them?
Well, now I seek them, I think, in my closest, oldest friends, and I seek, I seek connection through what I'm writing. I'm interested in the not just my own experience or my unique life experience with what we call mental illness and hospitalizations and breakdowns. I'm interested in what happens to all of us and to the to certain common conditions and ideas that we seem to have or feelings. I think that everyone I've ever known and who's gone through what I went through feels himself or herself to be a burden. We feel that that all of you would be better if we were gone. That's an instance of something that we could interpret not so much as sentiment or guilt or a threat, but as a reality. You know, for instance, we are difficult to live with. We are moving to a margin to a place where we're outside of the group. So I'm trying to write toward that, I want to connect with people who are marginal or feel themselves to be on the margins, who feel themselves to be unloved, who feel themselves to or who were. That's a connection that I really didn't understand before all this.
As you walk through this, do you find that you meet more people who feel themselves on the margins? I mean, is that a self-perception that may or may not be accurate?
Yeah, I mean, it's a function of illness. It's a function of isolation. It's a function of not belonging. I mean, that's what happens when children are bullied on social media. You're being pushed out of your place. You know, what I was trying to say earlier, I think, about this in my own life is it introduced me, you know, to a part of the world and a part of experience that I didn't really know anything about. I didn't really know about all this, and so talk about a culture shock, you know. So I think about different things now, and I think about people differently. And so an important connection for me would be a connection with readers who maybe have a moment of solidarity with the writer, or a moment of insight with the writer, or a moment of grief with the writer, right? So I don't really I don't really worry so much that that my story is different from your story. I think my story and your story are very similar if we're in that plight, if we're sick in that way, you know. And people do talk to me about it. If you go around the world talking about this, people will come up to you and they'll say, you know, I'll tell you my story. So I hear people's stories all the time.
So what I'm getting is that part of your mission now is to destigmatize what we call mental illness.
Absolutely. That's why I'm doing this.
And there are certainly degrees of mental health and mental illness. Do you ever think about, it seems like we're so focused often on the pathology instead of the health. And that's sort of fairly new element of psychology or psychiatry in terms of focusing on what makes a human mentally healthy. But is that part of this for you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, that's something that I talk about with my own doctors all the time. Not what it means to be sick, but what it means to be healthy. And if we accept that suicide is connected to isolation and trauma in isolation, then we have to accept that the etiology is social. So I think that there's no real cure for depression and suicide without integration and or reintegration, or without bringing people closer, without acceptance. Stigmatization is sort of, I understand, as a kind of a social component of the larger of the illness itself. You know, once you're stigmatized, you're not really living the same life, you know. So yeah, so I'm in a position where I can write, I can try to do this, and I can publish. I feel that this is an obligation, really, almost, that I have, and a privilege. If I can make a story that speaks to other people with this, that would be meaningful to me and to others, I think. So, you know.
You're listening to Coastline. Donald Antrim is a writer for The New Yorker. He's the author of three novels, one memoir, and a collection of short stories. He's also a MacArthur genius, and he's with us today. Just a few minutes left in this discussion on this Thursday. 910-343-1138 is the number to call. You can email us at coastline@whqr.org. Brian writes, "I must say, as a sufferer of mental illness, writing poetry and prose is how I live vicariously through my characters. I've been hospitalized," he writes, "many times because of my illness, and writing was my method of catharsis and healing. Mental illness is not the last stop. It is merely a switch of the tracks."
That's really nicely put, you know. Yeah. Freud writes at some point that he sees psychosis and the psychotic break as a break in the course of a life. I don't really see that. I see one life. I've had one life. This is very well put. I'm going to agree with that. Yeah.
Patrick from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Well, thank you very much. I'm absolutely spellbound by the talk, Donald, and I mainly just want to say I want to thank you for doing what you're doing, talking about it, and I'm very pleased. And I am a reader, so I'm going to read your stuff. Well, and I'm very excited about that.
Well, and I want to return the thanks for calling and saying that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Well, keep well. You're very welcome. Yeah, and I have depression issues, and yeah, it's not real fun.
No, it's not.
Hospitalized by my own, I chose to do it, but I was only in for 3 days,
yeah.
And I couldn't wait to get out.
But you chose to do it. That's an important thing.
I did. Yeah, I needed to do it. Yeah, I was in a bad way.
Good for you.
But yeah, got it. And then I got a lot more work to do. But
You doing okay?
Yeah, I've got a good life, and it's up and down, and dealing with loss and loss in the past.
Oh God,
Patrick, thank you so much for calling in and for sharing your own struggle.
Yeah, thank you so much, and take care of yourself.
Good luck to you. You know, I understand that you say your early fiction is written with these conceits, and it was complicated and maybe something of an intellectual exercise. But for those folks who are listening who haven't read Elect Mr. Robinson for a Better World or The Hundred Brothers, I do hope they read it. I was afraid of it and then started reading, found myself laughing out loud through most of the books and became a little obsessed.
Those books are, they're predictors for all this. I mean, they're lonely men. They're narrators who are in rooms and describing the loss of their own lives and their own worlds and their own families. They're funny books, but they definitely lead the way. There's the characters, the narrators are not really like me, but they've got some of my problems.
And John Jeremiah Sullivan writes about you, your fictional universe is different. It doesn't bend toward justice, not even the kind that knows there is none, but sort of hopes art can provide absolution. His universe bends, it's definitely bent, but always toward greater absurdity in both funny and frightening guises.
I just wanted to have some peace of mind during each day when I could sit down to work and not be terrified and do something productive and mess with paragraphs. And that would calm me down and it would make me feel like I could, have the day even. So when I was getting started, I didn't have a plan. I just had a need to do this. And so, the idea of writing poetry or writing anything or doing something that connects you that way to others is very, very important.
So this is sort of random and a side issue, and we're getting close to the end. But
you're right.
In Mr. Robinson, you have this character, a former student of the protagonist who'd produced a science fair essay on annual coastal erosion due to global temperature shifts and resultant polar ice cap meltdown contributing to rising sea levels. So this would have been 1992 or 3 that you wrote that?
Yeah, that's right.
There
were all kinds of things that went on in that book and others that I think the schools are closed down in that county, and I think 6 months after finishing this or a year or so, there were counties in California closing their schools, because of economic crisis and so forth and so on. So I think that I'd read about climate change. I think that when I first read in the New York Times, the first thing I read about that panicked me, and that was around that time, I think. So I probably didn't make it up. I think I was coming from, some anxious newspaper reading,
That makes sense. Have you reintroduced cooking in your life?
Absolutely. I've reintroduced a lot of things. I'm married now. I have music in my life. My wife is a pianist. And I cook all the time. Yeah. Why not? It's the best thing to do.
That's this edition of Coastline. Donald Antrim, what a pleasure having you with us today.
Thank you. Thank you. It's really a pleasure to come and talk to you. Thank you.
Coastline's producer is Rachel Keith. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caitlin Freund is our webmaster. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org. Get the podcast, find it on the HQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 3. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.